Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Obama is out, Trump is in, and what does it all mean? Politics produces winners and losers. That's the nature of democracy, right? And thus we, the citizens, we end up feeling like winners and losers too. Or so we think. I mean, come on, nobody really knows what's going to happen under the Trump administration, but we know things will be different. If we eavesdrop on our collective family feuds and Twitter fights, we see elation and relief on one side and gloom and doom on the other. Some people cannot wait for the Affordable Care Act to go away. They hope their premiums will get cheaper. I was texting with one of my doctors and he said, "It's not like healthcare can get any worse," so there's that. Other people are scared to death that they won't be able to afford their medications or treatments. Somebody told me on Twitter, "Not much we can do, diabetic in the house, and insulin only lasts so long." A woman told me she was ordering a breast pump ASAP while her insurance is still paying for it. In terms of science, a lot of scientists are afraid of the future of climate change. Will it be defunded? Others are excited about Trump's positive stance on genetically modified foods. So on today's show, we'll take a look at health and science issues that are on the cusp of big change. We'll find out why Silicon Valley is on edge about possible work visa reforms.
85% of the H-1B visa are going to programmer, analyst, and electrical engineers.
We'll meet a doctor who put his life on the line researching insurance plans that could replace Obamacare.
I should have gone to the hospital, but I knew there was a big bill waiting for me if I did, and I rolled the dice.
And we'll talk to a scientist who's also a politician about his thoughts on what's next.
You know, in the past, the Greeks would try to see into the future by analyzing bird entrails, and now instead of analyzing birds, we are analyzing tweets.
But first up, Trump's victory was fueled in part by coal country. He made a simple promise that scored major points with miners.
Coal's coming back. That's all that man had to say to get the vote down here.
That's Marty Cottingham. He mined the Blue Creek coal seam in Alabama for 34 years. And sure, a coal comeback is about jobs and economics, but he says it's about more than that. It's about an identity, a way of life, a community that is disappearing. Our science reporter Irina Zhorov went to visit him in Alabama.
In 1982, Marty Cottingham spent a night standing on the side of a narrow country road, waiting in line for an interview at the local coal mine. It was one of the best-paying jobs in the area, and he got hired. He still recalls his first day of work.
I remember I was so proud. I was 19, just turned 20, and I didn't want to take a shower. I wanted my family to see me when I come out of there because I was dirty, and I just felt good.
He worked the night shift 6 days a week. He'd get in a little early, get ready, then take an elevator, what he called the cage, down.
When you're standing on that cage, you're looking down, it's got a grated bottom, and you look like you're looking down a gun barrel. And down there at the bottom, it looks just like a grave, you know, an open grave. You go down to it. You always want to just ask the good Lord when you, before that cage dropped down, ask him, "Let me see the daylight again."
Underground, he relied on a little light on his head to grope through the darkness. He worked various jobs. At times, he ran the miner. That's the machine that shears coal from the rock face.
When you get to running that coal, you just get happy. You just get happy. You're just eating away at it. I mean, you're the miner, that's what it does, and it just, yeah. That's just the way it gives you.
For years, he also worked as a roof bolter. That's the person who goes in after a section of rock is mined out to drive rods into the newly exposed ceiling so it doesn't collapse.
I had a federal inspector tell me, said, "You know, you're just like an astronaut. You are the first man to walk out there where you're supporting the top. I just thought that was cool, you know?
The earth revealed wonders to him as he worked.
I've seen oil just start pumping out of the rock, just oil. Look up and see just a wall of crystal, quartz rock. You know, it makes you think, you know, there was something here before. You know, there was, you know, there, and trees, limbs, ferns, everything like that.
Other things he wouldn't talk about as much, like the fires. Methane made the very air volatile, and there was so much gas in the mines, he says he initially used a brass-headed hammer to avoid hitting a spark. About 15 years ago, high methane concentrations made him pass out and fall off his machine. He says he's got the body of a 70-year-old man, though he's just 55.
I have two herniated discs in my neck, two bulging discs in my lower back, compression fracture to my spine. I tore all the muscles away from my chest wall. And my hearing's gone. My rotary cups are gone. You know, my knees are shot. I have what you call hammer toes from wearing rubber boots. But other than that, you know, I'm all right.
Even with all the hardships, Cottingham thanks the coal mines for just about everything he's got. His house, his financial comfort, even his 18-year-old twin daughters. Literally.
They're mine and my wife's, but she had messed up tubes. And thanks to the coal mines being able to make the money, I had it, artificial insemination. I was able to afford it.
Cottingham retired this October. The company he worked for, Walter Energy, declared bankruptcy in 2015, and a judge allowed the corporation to renege on the contract it had with its workers. Cottingham says the insurance and benefits the new company offered weren't as good, and his nearly six-figure income would have decreased by almost half. So, he left. But that doesn't mean he doesn't miss it. We get in his car to drive out to the mine where he worked for all those years.
Okay, we are headed to Brookwood, Alabama, Jim Walter, number 5 washer. That's where I spent my biggest part of my mining career, was at number 5 mines.
Driving on a 2-lane Alabama country road framed by cuts of red soil, we glimpse coal piles, quarries. We pass through tiny Brookwood, a town built on coal, past a church where miners gather every year to commemorate a fatal 2001 accident. We park facing the stilled conveyor belts of the number 5 mine.
I feel good sitting right here. I do. I've got chills. This is where I spent my life. And, you know, I'm proud of my coal mining days. I really enjoyed it.
There's so few people that would describe their job in such emotional terms. What is it that makes you feel that way about it?
Well, it's the people.
He says the bonds between the miners, intensified here by the danger of the gases, made his years underground some of the best of his life.
You got that love for each other that just don't come from just anywhere. It's something that you as your brother, and you've got to always remember, you are your brother's keeper, and your brother keeper, you've got to take care of each other, because who else down there in that hole beside the Lord don't help you?
He and many of the men he started with were young. They grew up together in that mine, gave the mine their best years, spending 60 to 70 hours per week together. So the bonds between them were joyful.
We used to play. Everybody would save their sandwich bags. And on the way out, we would have water bag battles. People wouldn't drink their water just to play on the way out riding the bus. I mean, things like that. It don't sound like nothing. But, you know, it was fun. You know, it was just enjoyable.
And he says it was not unusual for the men to talk each other through serious personal issues.
I was working with a man, and I'd been working with him for a few days, and he said, "Marty, there's something bothering you." And he said, "I know it is." He knowed me. He could tell. And I said, "Well, Leroy," I said, "I have an autistic daughter, and I'm having a hard time accepting that. A man put his arms around me and he looked at me and he said, God don't make mistakes. He give you that daughter because he knows you'd take care of it. Now, would you expect to hear that from a coal miner?
It sounds like there's almost two losses for you, right? The loss of like a steady income, but then also the loss of this sort of other culture and camaraderie.
It's a big loss in my life, and that's one reason that as of right this minute, I'm really thinking about going back to work, because I'm not old enough not to work. And that's all I know. I run heavy equipment, and I'm a coal miner.
Irina, what has Marty been doing since he retired from the mines?
I checked in with him recently. He said he hasn't gone back to the mine yet. He's working full-time, operating a front loader, and then he's also delivering pizzas part-time. So still working something like 60 hours a week, just not in the mine.
Now, he mentioned a lot of different health conditions. Does he still have insurance?
So per his contract at the mine, he was supposed to have 100% covered insurance for the rest of his life.
Wow.
After the bankruptcy went through, that went out the window, obviously. So for now, he does have insurance, but it expires in April. And so last session in Congress, there was a bill that was supposed to funnel money into this fund to keep it funded for retired miners like him. That ultimately failed, but it has been reintroduced in both the House and Senate. A Democrat from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, who was really pushing it last session, he said he's met with Trump. Trump supports the bill, so we'll see what happens. If it doesn't pass, you know, he's out of insurance.
Speaking of Trump, obviously he said he would bring coal back. That was a big selling point. Can he do that realistically?
So there's two types of coal. One is used to make electricity, and it's been edged out by really cheap natural gas. The other kind of coal is used to make steel. And right now in places like Europe and China, where a lot of our coal goes, they don't need as much steel. They've been growing slowly. There's been a slowdown. There's not as much demand. Less demand for steel means less demand for coal. These are really global forces, and there's not that much that Trump can do about those.
Did you and Marty talk at all about climate change? It seemed like he had this deep love for his job, but also for the earth.
Yeah, sure. So he told me that he's an outdoorsman. He's a hunter. He cares about the environment. But he also told me that the miners, you know, they would take a cookie break. They would sit around and talk about politics. And if climate change came up, which he said it did not very often, if it came up, they would laugh about it. Hmm. It just was the sort of thing that seemed too abstract. He could say, I got my house because of coal, my community, everything here is built on coal. But connecting coal to climate change was more abstract. He actually told me that he doesn't believe in it.
How does he feel about his decision to vote for Trump?
He's still very optimistic, but with a caveat.
Until he proves himself, he can't be called a good president. He can't be called the best choice until he proves himself.
Thank you, Irina.
Thanks, Mikan.
I've got a man in the bam of mine. I can spend his dollar.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mikan Scott. We're talking about the changing of the guard in Washington on today's show. And President Trump's team has hinted at overhauling a program that offers work permits for highly skilled foreigners. These permits are called H-1B visas. About 85,000 of them are granted every year. They are already very sought after and hard to get. And the tech industry has fought for years to expand this program. So right now, Silicon Valley is really on edge that they won't have the workers they need. Our California Pulse contributor Andrew Stelzer told me that the startup boom of the last couple of years has created high demand for tech employees, and he tracked down one of these H-1B holders.
Pradeep Bhadrachalam. This guy has really made a home for himself in California. He has three dogs, he rides a motorcycle, drives an SUV, he hikes in the mountains, and of course, shops at Costco. Those oversized shopping carts you hear are as American as apple pie.
Good morning, welcome to Costco. Thank you.
This Costco store is in the Bay Area suburb of Fremont, California. walking up and down these aisles filled with giant boxes of cereal, laundry detergent, and frozen tilapia, Pradeep Bhadrachalam recalls the first time he entered one of these huge warehouse stores. It was about 9 years ago, soon after he arrived from India.
We don't have anything like that in India. It was very weird.
Back then, Bhadrachalam was doing his PhD in nanotechnology at the University of Texas at Arlington. Today, he's shopping for some basics: olive oil, salad greens, and a giant pack of organic chicken legs.
I guess you're not vegetarian.
My girlfriend is virtually. She doesn't eat meat at all.
Well, you got a lot of chicken there.
That's for me and dogs.
Oh, you feed the dogs organic chicken?
Yeah, whatever I eat.
Very nice.
Not everyone can afford to feed their dogs organic chicken, but Bhadrachalam makes over $100,000 a year doing something that many of us wouldn't even understand. He's a process engineer at Lam Research Corporation. His job is to design tools which are used to make semiconductors, key components of electrical circuits.
My plan was just to do master's and go back. Yeah, I wasn't planning on staying here or even working here.
The H-1B visa gives him a few years to decide. It's good for 3 years, can then be renewed for another three, and sometimes even longer. So he's here, like hundreds of thousands of others, guest workers in lucrative tech jobs.
85% of the H-1B visa are going to computer programmers, and electrical engineers.
That's Giovanni Perry, professor of economics at the University of California at Davis. Originally from Italy, Perry himself used to be in the U.S. on an H-1B before he married an American. Perry's research has found that foreign workers here on H-1Bs not only help their American employers profit, their presence also helped create more jobs within that company.
If they were to go away, we would just have a slowdown in the growth of that sector.
But the program has plenty of critics who feel that the jobs that go to foreign-born workers could be given to American citizens instead. One of the most iconic American companies, Disney, got blowback when the entertainment giant laid off hundreds of their tech employees and replaced them with foreign workers, many of whom came directly from India. In their last weeks on the job, they were asked to train their own H-1B replacements. One federal judge said Disney did not violate the law, but there are still legal actions pending, and lawmakers are split on what needs to be done.
The idea that you can legally hire a cheaper foreign worker and replace an American worker for a lower wage is illegal. It's illegal.
That's Republican Senator John Cornyn.
And if it's happening, it ought to be prosecuted. It ought to be enforced. But the idea that somehow H-1B is a way to bring in cheap foreign labor and fire Americans is false, or at least that's not what Congress has intended, and that's not what the law says.
The government only gives out 85,000 new H-1B visas each year. Last year, more than 230,000 people applied for the 85,000 spots. A lottery decided who got in. Everybody else was out of luck. 2 years ago, Pradeep Bhadrachalam didn't get picked and had to stick around on another non-renewable work permit. He worried he'd have to go back to India, where he'd be earning less and not utilizing his PhD-level skills in education. He reapplied for the H-1B in 2016 and waited anxiously to see if his name would get chosen.
And luckily I got it this year.
How did you feel when you didn't get the lottery?
It's horrible that you spent so much. You worked so hard, you studied here, and you still couldn't go through.
Tech industry giants like Facebook and Google have lobbied to increase the number of new H-1Bs. As with many topics, candidate Donald Trump was on more than one side of the H-1B issue. At first, Trump said H-1B is very, very bad for American workers. Later, during a Republican primary debate, he softened his position on highly skilled employees.
They'll go to Harvard, they'll go to Stanford, they'll go to Wharton. As soon as they're finished, they get shoved out. They want to stay in this country. They want to stay here desperately. They're not able to stay here. For that purpose, we absolutely have to be able to keep the brain power in this country.
Professor Perry, who follows workforce trends, says Trump's unpredictability has the tech world on edge.
The Trump administration has not given any pragmatic and practical indication on what they will want to do.
Perry says if we want American workers to fill these positions, we need to ramp up science, technology, and engineering education to create more talented graduates. For The Pulse, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Alex Stern contributed to this report. Science and innovation are constantly shaped by politics. How much federal money will flow toward research? What ethical guidelines will shape the work? It's politicians who make those calls, but politicians often don't get science. Just ask Bill Foster. As a congressman with a PhD in physics, he is a rare species indeed. In fact, he's the only physicist there. He told me one big difference between politics and science is what constitutes a fact. He said in politics, you just have to repeat something over and over and over for it to become true. But there's more.
Well, sometimes I say that there's a long list of neurons that you have to deaden to convert a scientist's brain into a politician's. the logical necessity of staying on message. You have to realize that if you're going to run, for example, for the U.S. Congress, that you're lucky if everyone in your district, maybe they'll hear you say something for 15 seconds, and therefore it had better be your fundamental message. And so you say your fundamental message until it makes you sick to your stomach. And you have to lead with the conclusions. That's another big difference. A typical scientific presentation, you go through, you know, here are the questions that we're trying to answer. Here's the data that we've examined, the experiments we performed, and here are our conclusions. Whereas in politics, you lead with the conclusions. You say, this is what's going on.
How do you see your work there changing over the next 2 years until you are up for re-election?
Well, the chair of the Science Committee, as long as I've been on it, has been a Republican, and we've been following a mixture of a very partisan agenda on things like climate change and fossil fuels and so on, and what's often a very nonpartisan agenda. And it's interesting to see how when things like fossil fuels or the science behind climate change come up, we immediately retreat into partisan corners. And then when other things come up, particularly things having to do with the far future, then I think, you know, both parties come together because of the common interest in our shared humanity. An example of that was I was able to convince the Republican chair of the Science Committee, a guy called Lamar Smith, that it would be a very good idea to have a hearing on human genetic engineering. And there was a real thoughtful discussion about, you know, what this means and the timescale in which we have to react and the necessity of dealing with this in an international setting, which frankly is, you know, dealing with problems internationally is not the first instinct of both political parties.
Science can be an easy target, especially basic science. And when there is a change in administration, there's always concern, will science be valued for what it is? How are you feeling about that right now?
Well, one of the reasons that science is an easy target is that the payoff from particularly basic scientific research is measured in decades. And so you can be a hero, this year by balancing this year's budget, by cutting scientific research. And then when the damage is done to our economy, decades from now, you just blame it on the other party. And so this is it's a problem. And it's a reason that our country tends to underinvest in anything with a long-term payoff, things like neonatal care or education of young children. Because the economic damage is not immediately apparent. I don't know any solution to that. It's almost a fundamental design problem with democracy, except that you have to have citizens that will very consciously support people that keep their eye on the long-term best interests of the country and not trying to be a hero today by cutting budgets.
Are there small things you do to foster an appreciation for science in your everyday political work? Among your colleagues, your constituents?
Oh, well, people ask my advice all the time. You know, for example, when the Iran nuclear deal came up, You know, if you actually read the Iran nuclear deal, they had, you know, more than a page of reactor core specifications that specified in numeric detail what the Iranians had to do with their heavy water reactor so that it could never be used to make large quantities of weapons-grade plutonium. And so, you know, members of Congress from both parties would regularly come to me and say, Bill, what does this mean? And, you know, how do I deal with this and make a decision on that basis? And, you know, that's a very important part of my workload. But I also love, you know, going home to my district in Illinois and attending science fairs. My staff has found that when I'm ever, you know, just feeling dragged down by my job, getting me to a science fair where I can interact with these young kids just cheers me up no end.
Congressman Bill Foster is a scientist and businessman. He represents the 11th Congressional District of Illinois. Coming up, it's a topic that makes Americans uneasy, very uneasy.
We did learn about condoms. They used a banana to demonstrate it.
How sex ed became a hot-button issue in politics and what might be next. Still to come on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Physicians and clinicians who diagnose or play a role in supporting patients with cancer are invited to a half-day oncology CME event on Saturday, February 4th. Details at ctcaforum.org. That's ctcaforum.org.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the changing of the guard in Washington on today's show. So far, we've been to coal country in Alabama. We've checked in with tech workers in Silicon Valley. And now let's turn our attention to a topic that makes Americans uneasy. Each new administration has imposed its vision on this issue. The Trump administration will likely be no exception, and I'm talking about sex ed. Yes, in schools, pregnancy, STDs, condoms, the whole thing, with sweaty adolescents. How sex ed should be done has changed dramatically under different presidents. Do we tell kids the naked facts only or serve this info with a side of morals? And even though teen pregnancy rates are at an all-time low in the U.S., they are still higher than in other developed countries. So where will the birds and bees fly next? Alana Gordon has more.
Over the ages, sex education has been an awkward conversation. We're confusing, we're non-existent. All I had to do was ask a bunch of friends about their experiences growing up.
My main memory of sex ed in school is of acute embarrassment.
What I do remember are the flower babies. It was literally an inanimate bag of flour with plastic limbs that we dressed up in baby clothes.
We did learn about condoms. They used a banana to demonstrate it.
I remember the opportunity to wear the empathy belly, which is like a pregnancy suit. I was walking down the stairs in the high school and I fell down and no one helped me to get up. Awkward.
Fast forward to today. Now let's meet Tashara Morton. She's 15.
Most people that are my age and around my age, they know about sex, and it's like around you is like a lot of pressure.
Pressure to have sex. Morton first took sex ed in sixth grade and again last year. She wasn't a huge fan, but
like it was slightly informative because like the things they went into detail about what happens to your body when you get a certain STI.
What happens during puberty, contraception options. Morton has been through a couple different sex ed classes, but the big one she remembers from middle school was based on the abstinence-only approach to sex education, which really focuses on the importance of not having sex. Over the last few decades, hundreds of millions of federal dollars have gone towards this approach. It's only recently, under the Obama administration, that's been challenged. But the idea of abstinence as a primary focus in sex ed in public schools really got started back in the early 80s under this man.
Have we been teaching sex as a purely physiological function, like eating when you're hungry?
In case you didn't recognize him, that's President Ronald Reagan.
Can we completely divorce sex education, as I'm afraid we do, from any association with moral behavior.
This vision and the federal funding that went with it has continued up until this day. During George W. Bush's 2 terms, it went up a lot. Valerie Huber is the national director of Ascend, a group representing abstinence, or what's now called sexual risk avoidance education programs.
We want to help young people avoid the risks altogether by waiting for sex, and among those who are currently sexually active, to return to a risk-free lifestyle.
In other words, abstinence, preferably until marriage. Here's a typical video clip featuring teen interviews that might be used in the classroom.
If me and Megan were to slip up and have sex before we get married, if we slip now, then where are we gonna slip in our marriage?
It's just amazing the difference of like our commitment and our love for each other, and we can still restrain from having sex until we get married, and it's gonna be like the most exciting thing.
But many in the public health sector have not been on board with this approach.
They will have sex eventually.
Emmy Stoop oversees sex education programs at the Public Health Management Corporation in Philadelphia and starts with the premise that kids are going to have sex.
And we want them to do it safely, and we want them to know where to go so that they can do it safely. But by pretending that they're not going to make that choice, we become irrelevant to them.
Educators like Stoop point to the lack of scientific evidence that abstinence-only programs affect teen behavior. There's also a concern that some of these programs contain inaccurate information, like on the reliability of birth control. Katrine Stanger-Hall agrees. She's a professor of biology at the University of Georgia. She fell into studying this issue after noticing how unaware so many of her college-age students were about their own bodies. For example,
students have no idea during which part of the female cycle pregnancy is most likely. They just basically have learned in school that having sex is something bad, which kind of prevents them from making educated health decisions as well as family planning decisions.
Stanger-Hall didn't dig into specific programs, but she mapped out teen pregnancy rates in states that had increased emphasis on abstinence education. She found they also had higher teen pregnancy and birth rates.
Students that are told not to have sex, to basically engage in abstinence only without any other information, they generally are much more likely to become pregnant because specifically they don't know anything about how to protect themselves when they do it.
The Centers for Disease Control recommends schools cover 16 topics to help their students protect themselves. Those topics range from the efficacy of condoms all the way to the benefits of abstinence. But a report released just over a year ago said fewer than half of high schools and only a fifth of middle schools covered all of those topics. For example, while sexual abstinence is taught in the majority of schools, where to find and how to use condoms is often excluded from the curriculum. Bill Albert is with the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. He says programs need to shift from ideological to evidence-based approaches.
That is, finding out through good evaluation what interventions work to change teens' behavior. Not just their knowledge, not just their intentions, but their actual behavior.
In other words, it doesn't matter whether the program is abstinence or a more comprehensive approach. Under the Obama administration, he says that's been happening. The big shift happened in 2010 with the establishment of the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Program. This meant tens of millions of federal dollars annually went into programs that didn't fall into that specific abstinence till marriage box. At the same time, there was an effort to reduce federal dollars for abstinence-only programs. That didn't sit well with Valerie Huber.
It has been a very disappointing time in the history of sex education over the last 8 years.
Huber is the national director of Ascend, the group representing abstinence or sexual risk avoidance programs.
This marked the first administration, Republican or Democrat, who has sought to eliminate totally one approach to sex education. So we're hopeful for the future, and we're looking forward to taking advantage of every opportunity to help young people thrive.
While Huber is hopeful about the future under the new administration, for Emmy Stoop, who oversees comprehensive sex ed programs in Philadelphia, this is a worrying time.
We're very concerned.
Under President Obama's administration, Stoop's programs expanded and received millions of new federal dollars. That funding will be up for reauthorization.
We appear to be facing a government that is particularly unfriendly towards this kind of work or fundamentally doesn't understand this work.
So there's another place where this kind of work is happening, and it's without federal or state dollars, politics, or much in the way of oversight. The rise of the internet, smartphones, social media, TV shows like MTV 16 and Pregnant, and YouTube.
What is the most common STI? Let's pretend that the title of this video didn't give it away.
This is Lacey Green. She's 27.
I am a sex education activist on YouTube and the internet.
The vast majority of us will contract at least one strain of HPV. That includes you, and that includes me.
Green has a really popular sex ed show on YouTube. She got into all of this a decade ago.
I did not have access to the information that I needed as a teenager and basically took to the internet to try to disperse the information that I was finding to my peers.
She thinks as long as sex ed in schools continues to be lacking, the internet will only grow in its sway. Her posts get anywhere from 200,000 to 3 million views. And she hears from a lot of teens directly.
You know, this morning I've been emailing back some kids who are 12, 13 years old asking about puberty and what's normal for their bodies and how to deal with unwanted erections at school. Basically things where you have young adults or even kids sometimes who don't really have anyone else to ask.
And somehow they find her. Green takes it seriously, but she worries. The internet is full of all sorts of wacky stuff. It's the Wild West. She thinks the ideal space to learn about it all is, yeah, back at school.
In a safe physical space with someone that they can talk to face to face, who they trust, who's giving them medically accurate, inclusive, comprehensive information about sexuality. But that is not the reality that exists in the United States. And so we really are left with the only other viable alternative that I see is the internet, and it's not perfect.
Oh, hi, babes. We've talked about viruses before on my channel, and today I want to talk about the big one, HIV.
So, given all this, what does someone like Tashara Morton, that 15-year-old we heard from earlier, make of her sex education class at school?
Did you, did it change or affect the way you thought about sex or being sexually active, if I can ask?
Well, it did and didn't.
Morton says her outlook stems from a combination of things. Yes, what she learned in school, plus the internet and TV. But at the end of the day, she says the biggest influence on her decisions came one day last year. Someone she knew had a pregnancy scare.
Like, it scared me as much as it scared her because, like, what if she really was pregnant? At one point, like, I was thinking, I was like, dang, like, what if that was, like, myself? What if that was me?
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the changing of the guard in Washington on The Pulse today. The Affordable Care Act has been the hot topic for weeks now. And if Republicans repeal it and replace it with a different approach, chances are they will rely heavily on high deductible insurance plans. 46 million Americans already have this kind of plan. I do. Basically, it means I'm responsible for the first $4,000 of care expenses for my family before insurance really starts to kick in. And we know that these plans curb healthcare spending, but we're just beginning to learn how they impact people's decisions and health. Dan Gorenstein is here now. He reports on Healthcare for Marketplace. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Maiken.
And Dan, you found a researcher who wanted to really get some answers. And he started an experiment.
Right. Yeah. No, it's sort of a crazy experiment in a way. He decided, his name is Dr. Ashish Jha. He lives outside of Boston. He teaches at Harvard. He wanted to put his whole family into a high deductible health plan. He wanted to see what sorts of decisions and choices they would make, what kinds of healthcare consumers they would be. So I caught up with Ashish the night he came home from this like amazingly brutal 11-day business trip. He was in Hong Kong, Paris, Florence. His briefcase got stolen, including his wedding ring. I mean, you can only imagine. The guy was sort of like out of it a little bit. And he opens the door. He unlocks the door, and the kids just bum rush him, right? They're yelling and screaming. He's wrestling with his 5-year-old son. you know, they're 11, 9, and 5. And as you can hear, they're really happy. They're also really healthy. And them being healthy, Mikan, has made it much easier for Ashish to do this high deductible experiment that he's doing.
I thought it would be really useful to have a sense of what it's like as a family, when I'm thinking about my own kids, I'm thinking about my own spouse and making healthier decisions, to know what it actually feels like to have to pay for everything out of pocket, at least until you hit your deductible.
Now, the family's on the hook for everything, checkups, the random strep throat prescriptions, until they hit their $6,000 cap. What kind of guy makes his family do that when he doesn't have to? The kind who's a doctor, a Harvard health policy professor, and someone who's spent the last dozen years trying to figure out how to make healthcare more efficient and effective for everybody.
And high deductible health plans are supposed to be one of those things that's supposed to make the healthcare system work better. And none of us has the exact right answer for what American healthcare needs to look like.
The whole idea behind high deductibles is to make sure consumers have skin in the game. Unlike a $30 copay for a doctor's visit, the hope is when people absorb the entire cost for that appointment, they'll be more price sensitive. What experts like Ashish have known for decades is high deductibles force us to cut back. The question is, what do we cut back on? The wasteful stuff, like name brand drugs instead of generics, or the critical things, like canceling a cardiologist appointment when you've got heart disease. The expectation is people like Ashish and his wife Deb Stump will hunt and find great deals, and doctors and hospitals will in turn make it easier to shop, for example, by making prices more transparent. The reality, says Deb, is they've been forced to do a lot of guessing, for example, when their son needed a follow-up after his surgery.
In the past, I would have just called and made the appointment. This time, I was pretty sure since I was a specialist, it was going to be quite expensive.
Good luck trying to find a doctor who can tell you how much the appointment will cost in advance. Welcome to the family's new normal. Unknown prices and feeling unsure whether it's worth it.
I sat on it for a while and then I called Ashish and Ashish said, yeah, you should probably have the follow-up. So we went and it was probably a two-minute visit and ended up costing $465.
I don't think any of us should be confused. This experiment, it's stressful, it's difficult, and it may not get us where we want to go.
Of course, the tempting conclusion here is if Dr. Ashish Jha can't figure this out and he's this Harvard health policy wonk extraordinaire, what hope can the rest of us have?
What I take away from Ashish's story is that simply calling the patient a consumer doesn't make buying healthcare anything like buying cars and computers.
That's Harvard economist Amitabh Chandra. He also used to be a fan of high deductible plans until he did what's become one of the most important studies on this. Chandra and his colleagues looked at what happened to well-paid, tech-savvy employees at a Fortune 100 company who were switched into high deductibles and were given a state-of-the-art computer program to compare prices.
We found no evidence that consumers were learning to price shop after 2 years of high deductible coverage. None.
But what troubled Chandra even more was that employees, the healthy and the sick, skipped out on care indiscriminately.
Prevention, imaging, drugs, consumers were cutting back on all of those. And that's a sign that they don't really know what care is valuable and what care isn't valuable.
Here's the thing. The whole point of high deductibles is to get people to make better choices, and by doing that, they'll save the whole system money. And it works, sort of. You certainly save money, up to 15%, and we do make different decisions, just not the decisions people assumed we would. Chandra's work has helped solidify a consensus. High deductibles are great for healthy people. They come with cheaper premiums, and most of us are healthy. But if you're chronically ill, poor, or unlucky enough to get hit by a bus, they can be a disaster. And it almost was for Dr. Ashish Jha. The morning after he got back from that bruising business trip, his heart started pounding.
Imagine like running as fast as you can, and when you stop and your heart is racing, that continuing for minutes and minutes and minutes, it's not a great feeling.
Ashish has a condition where his heart can rev up. These episodes happen to him once or twice a year. It usually passes pretty quick. At half an hour, though, he was worried. At an hour, his wife wanted him to go to the ER.
And I was resisting it. She actually asked me, if a patient of yours called you with this, what would you recommend to them? And I said, oh yeah, that's easy. Go to the emergency department.
Even as the pressure in his chest grew, Ashish dug in. He didn't want to drop $2,000 or $3,000 or $5,000, even though he knew this could be a heart attack, even though he had the money to pay the bill. Did you make a mistake? Should you have gotten in that ambulance that morning?
Boy, that's a hard question to answer. I mean, you know, I should have gone to the hospital. But you know, I knew there was a big bill waiting for me if I did. And I rolled the dice.
He got lucky. After an hour, his heart started to slow down. Ashish's experiment is helping him see what more and more research is showing. High deductibles carry risks. In moments, they force you to be your own physician, something even a physician can struggle to do for himself.
And then, let me get this right. Here is a doctor who mm-hmm. is perhaps having a heart attack,
mm-hmm.
and he is freaking out over a couple of $1,000 he might be spending. I mean, that's crazy.
It is. And I mean, we heard Ashish sort of admit to it, right? Like, I made a mistake. And I think, Mike, and what's interesting about Ashish's story is that thinking about money and healthcare simultaneously can really distort what we do. And this is really sort of one of the scary pieces, potentially, of these plans.
And I guess when it comes to healthcare, you are taught in a way, better safe than sorry, better safe than sorry, right? But then all of a sudden, when $3,000 or $4,000 are sitting on the table, then maybe being sorry means I spent that cash when I didn't have to.
Yeah, I think there's a behavioral economic piece to all this. And I think one of the reasons why high deductible plans work, I mean, a lot of people will call them this blunt tool. And the reason I think they work is because they play on our psychology and how we behave. We don't want to spend the money, even if you do set a bunch of dollars, thousands of dollars aside, you keep waiting to use that for something when it really matters, when you get hit by the proverbial bus. And I think high deductibles, particularly in acute moments, are going to force more people to gamble.
How are Republicans thinking about these plans moving ahead, knowing these things? Could you design a plan like this in a way that steers us in a direction that makes sense? So we're both economically smart, but we're also smart in terms of our own care.
Yeah, there's this idea making its way around. It's called high value care or high deductibles 2.0. One source described it to me as. And I think that the simple idea is to design a plan, particularly for people with chronic conditions, so we're talking diabetes, asthma, COPD, things like this, where some of the preventative care that people know they need and some of their meds that they always take, those things would be either at low or no cost. But then if you need to go to see a specialist, you'd be on the hook for lots of other things. So it's sort of a smarter, high deductible plan where some predictable events in your life are going to be covered. But beyond that, sort of you're on your own and you need to be this sort of more conscientious consumer.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I've worked at it over these last couple of years. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Megan.
And of course, I'm only waiting to hit my deductible so then I can go like to every doctor I've ever wanted to see.
Work the system, baby.
I'm trying. All right. I have thought a lot about change over the last couple of weeks and how we humans deal with it. I checked out what scientists say about change, philosophers, shrinks, and finally I figured maybe I should ask my daughter. She's 6 years old and, you know, the future belongs to her generation.
Helena.
Yeah.
How do you deal with change?
What is change?
Change is when things are changing.
I get dressed in the morning and I change my attitude.
What else do you do?
Eat goodies.
Eat goodies, I can buy into that any day. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, and Elizabeth Fiedler. Alex Stern is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager, the associate producer. Tanya English is our managing editor. And Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next time on The Pulse, making decisions can be tough.
I was always known as the person who would stare at the sock drawer in the morning before being able to pick out a pair.
So if you can't pick out socks, how would you ever make a really tough decision where you're tortured by either choice?
Probably in that same second I thought, like, I'm hurting this baby.
We'll explore the space between a rock and a hard place. Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.